This feature has been brought to you by Slot Foundation, which needs your support to continue projects like these. Information on this recording and access to other recordings is available online at slot.org.
I'm just going to throw out a series of things and we can come back to them in discussion. I really related to what Euclides was saying when he implied that we write from the south, but we write to the world in a way. And that's, in a sense, what I wanted to come back to, because I wanted to revisit this question of what is the South? Does it matter? Has it changed since some of us first were invested in using that as a category of theory making? And how does it relate to many of the other things we talked about that seem to be either occurring simultaneously elsewhere, but also were global in their provenance? Either in their political economy, in the degree to which they were about processes like financialization, cultural processes that were of worldwide scale. And we also heard several people saying we need a more systemic approach to X, Y, and Z. So when John and I first wrote about theory from the South, I mean, we emphasized that we were really interested in a way in the role of the South in theory and theory making. And one of the concerns was that so much of the thinking that had been produced from places outside of Europe were really talking about global issues, but they tended to be provincialized. That's the way the provincialization went. You know, these were places you spoke from South Africa, you spoke from Mozambique, you spoke from Brazil or whatever. And when we wrote about the problem, we were interested in the fact that so many of these people were themselves the products of multiple crossings. You know, people from the north who'd come to the south, people from one part of the south who'd come to another, often people who were the product of displacements, and that's often, of course, what's been said about anthropological insights, that in some ways it's the product of a certain kind of displacement, often from relatively elite positions. But we also said about that the south is both, it's both a category and it's not a category. That it is in some senses a geographical location, in many senses it's not. What we were really concerned with there was a structural location, and one that was, when we used the term from Homi Bhabha, eccentric in one sense or another, outside maybe of centers of a politico-economic kind, of a theory-making or hegemonic cultural productive kind, but nevertheless not necessarily only in some place we would call the geographical South, because in fact there are multiple connections, they always were, and in the post-colonial, post-whatever world in which we live, the decentering, the multilateral nature of what we mean by talking from the South makes it a highly problematic question. Is much of the South in the North in the South? And many of the kinds of concerns we've been talking about really are about problems of global circulation. Still, indeed, often, nearly always, central peripheralized projects in which some centers of value production or politics or governance create margins off which they feed and to which they sell and to which they proselytize and sometimes for which they care. But nevertheless, that this is a much more worldwide phenomenon. We also had, so my question is, when is it useful? Yeah. And when does it impede our thinking? When do we reify the category? Yeah. And how do we think always about the fact that this is often a provisional ideological binarism that's imposed for various reasons, cultural, G8, whatever we may, in terms of the exercises of power, on something which is much more fluid and multi-connected. And that, from that point of view, a good deal of the things we were talking about here today, for instance, the kind of new, the hierarchies new and old, the empires that are built south-south, the degrees to which a good deal of the phenomena that we spoke about, whether it was Indian medicine in South Africa, whether it, in Africa, whether it was the circulation of various kinds of new forms of marketing, financialization, whatever, are occurring across the South, as we would have thought about it in terms of the Southern Hemisphere, and that it's not necessarily always that this is a place of collaboration, cooperation, political position taking, even although it is that still in many ways. At the same time, I think a lot of the things we were talking about today, ruination for instance, medical multiplicity, Innovation of one kind to another. Financialization, not only as a form of high capital kind of speculation, but what it does to the ordinary lives of people, to families, to the nature of care, to the nature of health and so on. These are things that are happening north and south. One need only go into the American inner city. One thinks about questions of the kind of bioavailability of populations. We talked quite a lot about that on and off today in places in Africa, for instance, or in Brazil. But I think about things like the opioid crisis, you know, in this country, in incarceration, the ways in which these kinds of projects and promises exist both north and south, and how we think about that relationship under those conditions. And so that's the first thing I wanted to keep up in our sight lines. The globalization of the division of labor, which is so much of the part of the world of our world that we're looking at, and how that's affected labor crises both in the north and in many parts of, I mean, in South Africa, for instance, and the way in which there are circulations of labor that occur, for instance, you know, the caring economy of Filipino women and so on, so that occurs across the world. These things cut across these divisions in ways that are very complicated, it seems to me, but always useful to keep checking. Then there's the question of sovereignty, and that came up a few times, but it was implicit in a lot of what we said about what we hoped the state would be, what we hoped the state would do, whether the state would memorialize and recognize certain forms of evidence. What happens when public health all but declines, when there's this kind of de-investment or ruination of institutions? How does that relate to the coming of markets, but not only markets, other forms of sovereignty, NGOs, forms of organized security, most of all corporations, and living in a world where the state has become like a corporation in many respects, right? We're living particularly here, but not only here. Trevor Noah is not the only person, my countryman from South Africa, who points the parallels, for instance, between what has happened to the state in the US and what happened to the state in South Africa, and that the parallels move back and forth and they're converging in many ways. But the state becomes more corporate, corporations become more state-like. Forms of theology organize across the world in ways, organized security, organized crime. Yeah. So there are these various forms of competing sovereignty within and across nation states, and they cause the kind of multiplicities, the complex and ever more marbled entanglement, it seems to me, of public and private and other forms in between. And this is where I liked your idea very much, Ron, about what lies behind the global, what lies beyond. And of course, we now are living in the world of corporate private global philanthropy. Many people mentioned the Gates Foundation. But we also, in many places, also live in a place where there's a re-evaluation of indigeneity and its forms of knowledge and its forms of production and as a kind of heritage and even as a form of capital. So these multiplicities exist in very complicated ways, and they molded into each other in extraordinarily interesting kinds of examples. And it seems to me that in imagining futures, these are the ways in which they come together, both productively and in ways which are exceedingly disconcerting. I loved the toilet example. I want to come back to it, the kind of toilet as total social fact that we talked about this morning. But I don't know if any of you have read Brenda Chalfant's piece on Wastelandia, which is about a whole city, a kind of Hobbesian state that was built on the same kind of crisis that Peter was talking about this morning. A philanthropist comes back from England to his home country, and in the northwest wasteland of Ghana, he builds a public toilet, which becomes a kind of facility to which people accrete, and he begins to build a business around it. He begins to sell small things. There's a toilet, there's water, there is childcare, there's an artistic project, there are forms of labor, and he builds a whole kind of state form around this notion of a kind of utopic world that starts with this problem of infrastructure and builds it out into a kind of, and increasingly he's building small dimensions of profit into the story, and it's this idea of the win-win building of a state. So those kinds of examples. There are other examples one can cite. We were just talking here about the kind of cruel optimism of certain forms of technological frontier in Africa, like the promise of oncology, for instance. And of course, Judy's written wonderfully about this, but I supervised the thesis from an undergraduate from Kenya this last year, and it was an extraordinary account of the coming of this cutting-edge technology as a mega-state project in Kenya. Only it was so uneven in what it could provide, and it was so drawn into what was the readiness and the creativity of the market to run ahead of it, that we had instances of people who were taken into that hospital, prescribed chemotherapy, told to run across the road to the private clinic, where a clinic that was indeed sparkling new and completely privatized, sold all the forms of available cutting-edge chemotherapeutic drugs. Next door was a credit union that would extend the credit to make the buying possible. And this was done within a short time so that the patient could rush across the road again to Kenyatta Hospital and have his treatment. And what one saw there was the coming together and then the forms of management, the forms of indebtedness. Along with all of this, the promise still that what was being brought here was something that had been, that people had been deprived of, and it was bringing them some kind of form of life. So still that sense that from the north came this form of treatment, but it came in this extraordinarily complicated form. So those implications and what that means in terms of things that Kaushik was talking about, in the nature of global capital now, how this is playing into all of this, that in fact capitalism is many things at once, but dominant is the form of financialization, and that financialization drives many of these large processes we are seeing in places like Brazil, Africa, India, but it also driving increasingly very small microcosmic domestic processes. So things like the extension of credit, the indebtedness. Yeah. Somebody said a while ago, the real revolution in South Africa was the revolution of credit. That's really what's happened. And people that South Africa is the highest rate of domestic borrowing in the world. But the degree of governance through credit, the degree of policing through credit, the degree in which the family becomes a management group, where the whole life cycle is constantly interrupted by these crises of what has become the privatization and financialization of life itself. Yeah. Schooling, childcare, infertility, and funerals, all of these things have become extraordinarily complexly interconnected, and whereas before there was a sense that there was a kind of state welfare that to some degree in countries like South Africa after apartheid allowed people a kind of predictable life course and a structure of social reproduction. A lot of this has been intervened in, so these questions of financialization are at the most intimate and interpersonal levels, but they also imply a kind of speculative optimism, a kind of hope that is driven, and that the roller coaster of despair and optimism that's linked to things like, by the way, in these places, growing suicide rates and so on. So there's a very direct connection. Quickly, because we're running out of time, I wanted to connect that and these economic changes to what's happened to labour. And here I wanted to come back to a discussion that Julian Kaushik had earlier, because it seems to me that it's crucial to the kinds of things we're all looking at. However much things happen in abstract space, in fact, the groundedness of production or the absence thereof, of work and the absence thereof, and what counts as labour, and this question of care, which I myself have used several times already, and we were saying, I worry very much in the field that many of us share in medical anthropology, that there's a kind of explosion of care to fill a space, and I want to know why. In a sense, nobody cares, and that's the problem. Who cares is the problem, but we're all talking about care, and care can mean everything, from the gift relationship to Arthur Kleinman to Lisa Stevenson killing people through care, to care as revolution, care as patriarchy, care as... And so the whole question of what that... And care is labour. And often the labour of care, which is not only that of experts and physicians, it's that of the people who, clean up the shit and turn the old people in their beds, the work of elder care that is a problem all over the world. It's often the most lowly, the most feminized, often the illegal immigrants in African societies and elsewhere in our own that do that work of social reproduction. Now, I'm wondering here, how that relates back to the question that we in anthropology also, I think, are guilty of at present. We put the word labor in front of everything or behind. It's affective labor. It's informal labor. It's non-productive labor. It's caring labor. It's carceral labor. It's criminal labor. And I'm wondering the degree to which labor itself in this process, both at that level And in terms of the histories of capital of which we were speaking when we talked about the end of the road with Gauchy, whether this is still the labor of abstract value, whether this is the labor of the labor theory of value, whether this is the labor of the end of work, I'm not sure that I agree with Jim Ferguson. Paid wage labor, the formal contract may be over. People are still working. So the informalization of labor, what does that mean? How does that relate back to many of the things that we're talking about? I think that needs to be thought of. And finally, Kaushik, to come back to a question that I wanted to ask you, but I think it's worth us all thinking about. If indeed labor may indeed be part of the way that things are coming to an end here, I mean, maybe that the end of capitalism comes with the boom and bust cycles of the subprime. Who knows? We've all become in some ways subprime in terms of the degree to which we are new virgin territory for financialization to exploit. But what I wondered, and I wanted to bring this back, is this question of how we think of politics in relation to, you know, the waiting for the end. There's a whole anthropocenic politics before us, you know, some of which is very constructive, some of which, in my view, is very problematical. But there is the question constantly we come back to is the law. And you raised the law, and a couple of other people did too. And I wonder, because, you know, and Peter made this point very well, particularly in post-colonies and post-totalitarian societies, there's a tremendous emphasis on constitutionalism. But simultaneously, many have argued that this has in a way been a pax neoliberal. You know, it's been a passage through into a new reality in which a language of rights, and this comes to the question also of whether rivers should have rights and whether that's the way we should think about them, you know, as social. It's a wonderful idea, but I wonder if this gets back into this kind of zero-sum struggling for rights rather than thinking systemically about the totality and the system of which we are part. But the question of law, Kaushik, for me, and I wanted to come back to this, is that it seems to me law has failed in so many respects, in fact, without politics, without movements, and that law tends still by and large to work for the powerful, although we have Lilliputian examples. Yeah? And particularly, it seems to me, you know, one always says, for my friends, justice, for my enemies, the law, right? And so I wonder about this question, particularly in the South African case, where the gap between the promise of a constitution and what is delivered has been a kind of scandal, which is why we now have a decolonization movement among young people on campuses. And why, in fact, it becomes highly questionable whether the Constitution itself can satisfy a young generation of black jurists who argue that it still remains a highly individualist, Eurocentric document. And that, in fact, the very idea of Ubuntu, which, I mean, I see where you're coming from with this, but it interests me that it's been external Kantian juristic theorists who have seen the value in this concept. And to try and bring it back to the notion of labor, I mean, it's dignity, sure. It's about collective concern and affect and caring. But how does it cut back to this question of labor, you know, materiality, inequality, the political economy, the extraction of value, all of these things that seem to be the challenging questions now? Thank you.
I am a historian as well as an anthropologist, and as I sat here today thinking about, you know, this question of what the speculative future is in this moment, which we recognize to be flush with toxicity, inequity, exhaustion of so many kinds, how did we get here, and what was the moment that preceded this moment, and how it. The reality of it seemed to come out of the blue, as all such moments seem to do. And I realized, the more that I thought, about the extent to which we're still, at least in this meeting, in the shadow of the AIDS epidemic. Mm-hmm. And there was like a little valley moment in the sunshine between the AIDS epidemic and the Anthropocene, Capitalocene, whatever you want to call it. And in that moment in the valley, there was a lot of possibility, and that possibility was foreclosed. The failed promise of queer politics is, I think, the tragedy of our times. The AIDS activist movement that put on the table something that was meant to look like a very radical form of universal, accessible healthcare for everyone turned into the narrow technological solution to the complex political and economic problem, and the biosocial community was smashed into bits, and the elite white men were hived off, and the people who had access to the drugs were hived off in another place, and all of a sudden we found ourselves in an archipelago of little islands of access and really perilous pitfalls in between. And in a place like the United States, it's as though there is, the AIDS epidemic is over. But meanwhile, if you look at what happens in communities of color, and in particular among queer people of color, queer men of color, their rates are incredibly high. So it's not that that one history is over and the next moment has begun. And of course, I think there are many people in this room who already know how to map that same seeming promise and failed promise within Africa, within Brazil, despite its successes, within other places of the global south. And so there's something about that recent experience that I think is probably instructive for us. One of the things that I think is instructive about it, and here I'm echoing, I think in many cases, in many ways, what Jean already said, is the breakdown of this north-south binary, which is obviously false, right? There are enclaves and there are enclaves, there are parallels and there are parallels. And then there are relationships. So, for example, when I was hearing Kristen talk this morning about Colombia, I couldn't help but think about how that military-driven toxicity is a relationship, one that occurs in the U.S. at the same time that it happens in Colombia, just like it happened in the U.S. at the same time that it happened in Vietnam, such that there are 150 plus Superfund sites that are associated with military installations inside of this country. Or if we were to think about water infrastructures, which we heard about this morning as well, we would only have to look to the Central Valley of California, where many, many people go without water. Right here in the good old US of A, in the shadow of those people who grow those fucking wonderful almonds and are like sucking the underground aquifer dry in order to have their plantation economy. So we've had a plantation economy here from the get-go, from when the white people arrived, and it's still thriving. So we have these, or we could look at what happened in Flint and how it's ongoing. We could think about Black Lives Matter and the fact that the technology of the cell phone, which we thought would remediate the problem by revealing it, only served to take something that people of color have long known existed in this country and turn it into a public lynching. Mm-hmm. Now it's not just that the police kill black and brown people, it's that you're meant to watch it. And so the caution, the political power of it only escalates via this mobile handheld technology. So there's a pivot back and forth between the subversive and the activist and the pushback or blowback that goes in the other direction. And that back and forth, I think, helps map the ways that the North and South is a real relationship of inequity and power and all the rest of it, and also in many ways a false binary that hides many things in its shadows. And they sit there as open secrets unless we name them, including the one that Jean named, which is the medical testing subject. I always say that I am quite confident that one of the reasons that global health had to be invented and every American medical school had to go to Africa and have its little ward where it did its experiments was because people in West Philly, in Mission Hill, in Boston, in the south side of Chicago, where all these fancy medical schools are, were like, you know what? I'm done. And so the vision is I'll go somewhere where people will just say, thank you, you brought me care. And I think we might still be in that moment, but that moment may well end. So to say it's a relationship, though, extends beyond the fact that there are parallels and into these larger entities that we've gestured to when we've talked about the corporation sovereignty and the nation state. But I want to name a few of them as these big sprawling conglomerations that are so slippery that they're hard to put their finger on. And they include the petrochemical industry, the U.S. military, the pharmaceutical corporations, which of course have been named here, and they are all entirely related to one another. The military-industrial complex and the medical-industrial complex are born, they are wrapped around one another, inside, through, and outside. If we want to talk about oncology, we go right to mustard gas. Mm-hmm. We go to Hanaford. We go, I mean, there's nowhere to go that you don't run up against the military or in and out of the military and the petrochemical industry. So we're looking on the remediation side here in this meeting, except for Kristen's paper. And I think it's important to put both of those pieces together, that the money-making apparatus of remediation is predicated by the same money makers who make the mess in the first place. So we're in a profit cycle. And I think it's worth naming it as such. I don't want to reduce it to that. There's obviously a lot more going on than just that. But to look at the totality of the relationship, I think, is probably worthwhile. In light of that, or not only in light of that, but in terms of the conversation we've had today, I kept thinking, what is the political vision? What kinds of political vision are possible? And I feel like one of the difficulties that we have politically in our current moment and in our recent history, and that all of this, the many amazing papers that you all presented today about technologies and commodities point to, is that we are in a consumption-driven growth model. And all of our politics, or not all of them, but many of them seem to be channeled toward that. That's why I gesture toward what happened with HIV. Because it turns into, give me that drug, as versus remediating much bigger, broader conditions that maybe I want to consume less rather than more. Maybe I want some things to shrink rather than to grow. Maybe we need to reintroduce a politics of distribution and redistribution rather than everybody pawing to get in line on the consumption train, given that the consumption train, if we were to look at both sides of the relationships of toxicity, militarism, and all the rest of it, are part of what are killing us in the first place. Where does that leave us? What's the scale at which it can happen? A lot of what we've heard today kind of keeps the nation state intact. But, you know, it wasn't long ago that that was fully in question and probably should remain with a question mark around it. What about the region? The transnational, we've heard about the global, the international, I'll add another one, the planetary. Then Peter took us to the municipal. We've heard about the biosocial community, the queer community that extends beyond any particular one population, the professional community, i.e. anthropologists. We could talk about it in terms of population, in terms of species. I mean, I could go on and identify multiple scalar iterations, but I think that naming them and figuring out what the connective tissue between them is really matters. And it matters because distribution is not even. And I think it was Apadurai who put that word flows out there, and it drives me nuts because it makes it seem like things are just flowing everywhere, and they don't. They're channeled through very particular directions with little gates that are opened and closed in very particular ways, both on the gray market and in the more formalized structures. And I think if we think about them in those ways, then we start to identify where some of the connective tissue lies within these different scalar iterations of where, when and where a political vision might lie. returning to the what is the political vision, I was so struck in Alice's paper this morning about the fact that, you know, well, we're not going to build a lab because that'll fail. And now it's as though that ship has sailed. Why can't we build a lab? I mean, it's incredible. It's such a diagnostic of our political moment that we would accept that being taken off the table. You know, that is now just like a truism that is meant to be somehow. I don't think it's everybody's truism, but it's a repeated truism. Meanwhile, there are billions of dollars floating around in speculative capital. It makes no sense. You know, national health systems, nations need health systems. Health systems need laboratories, not fancy little portable technologies, actual laboratories. And when that ceases to be a legitimate political claim, then it suggests to me that we need a rethinking of what the political vision may be, including one that speaks back and says, well, Jesus Christ, you can put a man on the moon, build a lab, and then give us some money and maintain it, period. Lastly, I think I will say something about the middle-income country, which was raised as a place from which to think. And maybe it's because I've always worked in a middle-income country that it just makes me feel relieved when I hear it put on the table. I think the middle-income country is incredibly important, and I think it's a really great place from which to think. There is that. There is the abject country. There is the highly capitalized, you know, quote unquote, first world high tech country. But the middle income country is a different kind of model for what might be possible, for how which kinds of claims can be made and which can't be made, to where capital is not understood to be limitless, to where maybe you could envision putting a roof over the top without letting the bottom fall out, et cetera, et cetera. And I think that along with breaking down the North-South, the low income, high income, has got to go out the window, and a close look at the middle-income country, to me, is often a place where you do find interesting and innovative politics. Look at public health in Iran, which is now eroding. But as a middle-income country, it's quite incredible, the extensive public health system that was built there. Look at Botswana, which is a middle-income country. You know, we could go on, look at Barbados. We can point to many places, but to always look to the U.S., Belgium, Switzerland, and Japan, or to Togo and say it's one or the other, I think is probably a false analytic move. So I'll stop there. Thank you.
Peter started with an observation, or not he started, he in between made an observation, said that we have lost trust in modernism. And I want to pick that up. I grew up with that sentence. I heard it before when I went to university in the early 70s in West Berlin. That was the dominant atmosphere. And we have lost trust. We was, limited definition, we the leftist students of the Free University in West Berlin, have lost trust in modernism in the sense of capitalist modernism, but also some of us, in the socialist version. And ever since the beginning of the 20th century, great thinkers of modernism, they never had any trust in modernism. So Peter saying these sentences, and I said, it's not a critique of what you are saying, I'll come back to that. But it's a repetition of an ongoing thing. Modernism comes along with catastrophism. And this touches on where Julie stopped. A second interruption to prevent you from believing that this is a logical sequel. I find it indicative that we meet here and not in the medical industrial complex through which Steve Feynman kindly walked me yesterday afternoon, which is the site where much of this happens, is apparently a high-tech center, well-resourced and globally connected, and they are doing what we are talking about, but we sort of withdraw in this alternative place and talk about what they do. I find this indicative, and again, I will come back to it. There is also a third and personal intervention, namely Heidi spoke about TATU, Transkei Alternative Technology Unit, and she showed a picture of 1983. Now, I was there. I freshly arrived there, and I was new to South Africa, and it took me a while, but I believe after a few months, I sensed what the situation is, and I totally disagreed with Cecil Cook, whom you mentioned. And we sort of were friends, but friends in a clear opposition to each other, and a respectful opposition. And the opposition was something like this. I realized that all those who support his NGO and his initiative were classified as right-wing conservative who are in support of the Grand Apartheid Project, having Bantu technology, while I quickly sensed that all the young and politically engaged ANC-oriented, Umkhonto, Sizwe-oriented students were totally disrespectful of that. They wanted something else. And I indicated this to Cecil, and he always wanted to give lectures at my department and wanted me to be functional, that he can give a course, and I prevented him from giving courses for that reason. So, and this now brings me to what I want to say. This is about consultancy, because what Cecil Cook was doing was having an NGO which presented itself as giving consultancy to the Transkei, which was a apartheid creation government. And it was hard to see who, in fact, wants this consultancy. And you clearly see it mentioned that the first thing you do when you are a good consultant is you deconstruct the terms of reference. Now, I can see what you mean, and this is not a criticism, but the same sentence I heard last year when I was at a meeting with the Society for the Study of Decision-Making Under Deep Uncertainty, which is a hidden branch of the RAND Corporation. And the RAND Corporation is so powerful that they indeed can sort of ignore terms of reference, or they have the power and the capital to negotiate even with the American government the terms of reference for the consultancies they get. But otherwise, the problem with consultancies, how can you do that? And that's now the point I'm trying to deal with. And this is about consultancy, recommendation, and speculation, because the title of this meeting was about speculation. And there is a established, conventional, and if you wish, old-fashioned, but I think still valid distinction. When you work as a scholar who is paid by the taxpayer, you are released from giving recommendations. But if you give a recommendation, you want to be paid for this recommendation. And what is it you are being paid for? It is for taking the responsibility that your speculation can be evidenced with facts. And for this, you need a standard. And this is the point where Peter's question about the standards come in. Because otherwise, each consultancy would go bankrupt if there was no standard. So having a speculation is fine, it's even necessary, but having a standard in order to prove the speculation against the standard is also necessary, and for no other reason than for the fact that otherwise you wouldn't have any business who is prepared to sell its consultancy. So this is not an epistemological issue, it's a juridical construction, and it must not be misunderstood as that. Now, in other words, in Euclides' paper, speculation was in the title, but I guess the more interesting speculation was in what he said. Namely, being paid for a recommendation is being paid for an evidenced, or in the future potentially to be evidenced, speculation. And this, in terms of Thomas Kuhn, is normal science. It's normal speculation, as opposed to extraordinary speculation, which is the sort of revolutionary stage of science. And in other words, if we speak about speculative futures, I think it's a good exercise to repeat what this word of speculation has in it. And I did a little bit of a homework, and I will take you through three steps of this homework. So I already mentioned the key part of it. There is Kuhn with ordinary speculation and extraordinary speculation, and that is 100% compatible with what speculation is in Popper. For Popper, science is speculation. But it took a while to get to this point, and now I'm stepping back. The point up to Popper and Kuhn, from where we grew up, is about doing away with metaphysical speculation in the so-called European Enlightenment. 17th, 18th century was from Francis Bacon through René Descartes, maybe up to Leibniz, and the consequences was to replace speculation with experimentation. And the enemy was metaphysical speculation. And ever since, there was a disregard for speculation. And this is how we learn to grow up with this word. And this is how everyday language is using the word speculation. But now the word is in high circulation. It is in high currency. And I have the slight fear that many of those who are now using this word don't check the humble time to see how this evolved. And so I looked it up a little bit. Replacing speculation with experimentation then became institutionalized for doing science, as Popper and Kuhn summarized it, but it also became institutionalized in pragmatism. And Charles Peirce has two papers on the guess. For him, it's guessing. And there is one paper which is actually called Guess. And for me, this was the obvious guess on my side. Where could be something interesting? It must be in pragmatism, because pragmatism is about the distinction between the rule and the practice. So if the practice is not rule-driven, but still there are rules, then this space in between is guessing, is speculation. And it's normal speculation in terms of Kuhn, unless there are extraordinary moments, and then it becomes extraordinary speculation. So in addition to Popper and Kuhn, we also have Peirce, who is speaking about conjecture and guess. So it's a very old word, which now has a surprising new value. One more addition, then I come back to our conference. Within especially American sociology, it was, I think it was Merton, I'm not sure, I didn't have the time to check it, who coined this notion of mid-range theories. And Parsons and Mills and Merton and everybody in the 50s and 60s, they agreed that grand theory is something disrespectful which we need to do away, and instead all we can do is mid-range theory. And that is this old antagonism between experimentation and speculation. But now this has become even more challenged than it anyway was. But to come back to Peter's comment, I think it is important to be reminded that it always has been like that. And one moment in sort of intellectual history, which was maybe tragic and funny at the same time, is Horkheimer rejected Walter Benjamin's habilitation thesis because it was metaphysical speculation and not possible to be checked against the facts. So this goes on and on and on. And now at the beginning of the 21st century, we are at a moment where everybody speaks of increased uncertainty and increased necessity for speculation. I guess it makes sense to say, okay, normal speculation is the heart of science, and it should stay like that. There is no reason to challenge that. And extraordinary speculation is fine, but again, it can and should be perhaps linked to normal speculation, and hopefully can be linked. And this is now about speculation, bringing the two things together, speculations, futures, and sows. And I'm happy about what has been said, so I just can repeat it. The South is not just in the South, but it is everywhere, as the West is not exactly in the West, as it is everywhere. So it is about something else. And indeed, there are sites or positionalities from where extraordinary speculation can be done better than in other sites. And I think all of these papers were excellent in showing these frictions between those sites where extraordinary speculation is necessary. And Peter's example with the flush toilet, which all made us feel horrible for the whole day because we are 50 people and each of us went 4 times to the loo and so on. So the amount of water and ecological destruction which we have produced is just amazing. So next time when we meet, there will be no flush toilet. This is OG for what now? So it comes to the point, so I'm repeating what Julie said, how to get out of this growth thing. And again, this question hasn't been raised for the first time, but it doesn't require now to believe that we are in a moment where something extraordinary in terms of speculation happens, because this, again, it has always been there. And it is related to the South, but the South is not really in the South. And in that sense, I felt that all of these ethnographic contributions were wonderful to think about these questions. Thank you.
So on top of a fabulous set of papers all day, we've had 3 wonderful provocations about sort of intellectual and political questions. And our challenge now is to all bring this together as our 50 people out there in the dark and see what we together can do with this. And just to a very modest effort to kick off a kind of conversation that would draw across all the papers, I just like to throw out one more small provocation. And it came as I was grappling with the first and the second panels together, and it struck me that there were really different scholarly aesthetics in each of those. Not as a critique of either one, right? They're addressing all of these important issues, but that, for instance, as a very quick sort of overview, the objects of the first panel were mint green butterflies and leafless trees and toilets and broken flasks and small mobile diagnostic tests. And the objects, it seemed to me, that cut across the second panel were more something more akin to improvisation, e-networks, transnationalisms, value, financialization, and communism. It strikes me that there's many things in the importance of that difference and the brilliance of our organizers in putting those two panels next to each other so we could feel those tensions. And something about that is, it strikes me, in the scale. And are where we think we might, as anthropologists and historians, intervene in what seem at times like an overwhelming scale of damage, and slippery, in Julie's words, configurations or collusions economically, socially, and politically. And it strikes me that our provocation for this workshop was in searching for a new vocabulary. And I wondered, as we went through the day, if it wasn't exactly a new vocabulary, but more that we're looking for a new historical narrative, a new way of, say, recognizing the transnationalisms in all nationalisms, or a new way of imagining intellectual histories that take seriously the disciplinary history of consultancy, or a new way of grappling with notions that there are alternatives to capitalism, be it thinking the sorts of at least surgings, if not resurgence, in ecology or the natures of communism. And this might draw us to a retrieval, as Richard brought up, of a mid-range theory, but it might also bring us somewhere else. And I wonder if the third panel offered us some possible solutions. And it struck me that in the third panel came back to us old categories appropriate technology, identity categories, consultancies, but all with a different twist, all with a sense of humor or irony or a kind of breaking open? And is it not a new vocabulary we need, but a new way of telling the histories that we sit with so profoundly? And perhaps to go back and to Rama's question, where she asked that Alice take up this idea of runation within Boston. Like, what would it mean to bring these kinds of categories that we're dealing with and bring them to the heart of where we sit today?